You're listening to Face Off, episode 65, recorded April 18th, 2010. Welcome to Face Off, your face-to-face web technology podcast. I'm one of your hosts, Jade Robbins.
And I'm Mark Sanborn.
And in this podcast, we talk about various aspects of web technology, such as web development, social media, and web entrepreneurship. As always, you can view our show notes by going to faceoffshow.com. All right, so let's get into our news and follow-ups this week. This week, we're kind of talking about, we've talked about, the theme of the show is sort of APIs. Right. I mean, we're going to talk about something specific, but so you actually found a web page with access to all of Google's APIs.
Yeah. Google is one of those companies that have a ridiculous amount of, programmer friendly tools, APIs.
Oh, man. Yeah.
Just everything. So we're going to have a link in the show notes. You can go check out. But anyways, they just have one giant list of all the APIs that they provide.
Yeah.
So
you can get to them. They don't all fit into what we're going to talk about later, right? Because we're going to talk about RESTful APIs, sort of what is REST and why you want to use it. But Google does have an enormous amount of APIs for pretty much all of their products.
Pretty much every tool. And then some tools you've never heard of, like PubSub, HubHub, which is like turn your Atom and RSS feeds into real-time streams, like stuff you might not have heard of.
That one's a mouthful, huh?
Yeah.
So check it out. It's code.google.com/more. All right, let's get into our geek tool for the week. And our geek tool for this week is something that I have and I really enjoy, and it's called the Cespresso H2O Plus Glass Water Kettle. And so I recently was trying to drink a lot more tea. As we've mentioned in the show before, we drink a lot of coffee. And there's, supposedly health benefits to tea. And so, and I just kind of wanted to expand my palate a little bit. So I needed an electric water kettle because the one on the stove takes too long and it's a pain. And I wanted it at work where we don't have stoves. So you need an electric water kettle. So I bought this. It's really cool. It's like it's a glass kettle with sort of this metal ball at the bottom where the heating element is. It'll heat itself and boil water in probably like 4 minutes. It's really quick. And it looks great.
Yeah, when you first got this, we did like the test. I was like, I didn't believe you because you're like, well, I can boil water in like, I don't know, a minute and a half or something. And I was like, oh, that's about how long it takes on a stove. And it is definitely faster.
Yeah, it wasn't a minute and a half. I was wrong about that. But it definitely is a lot faster than a stove.
So, I mean, yeah, you just put it on, do you put it on your desk or like what do you?
Yeah, I mean, I leave it on my desk. It has sort of like a maximum fill line. So if you don't fill above that, water usually doesn't slop around too much. But it's electric. It's cordless. They say cordless in that the base has a cord, but the kettle itself doesn't. So you put the kettle on the base and click it on, and it boils the water, and then you can take it off and go pour it on your cup without having to wire in your way. It also has some cool features, like it has an auto off. So, there is no chance of you accidentally leaving it on and letting it, boil all the water out and then exploding or starting a fire. Mm-hmm. Even if you boil water and then 2 seconds later turn it on, it's temperature based, so it'll like start heating up and then realize that it's at the temperature it needs to be and shut off. So you can't like overboil water or anything. It's not timed. It's based on the actual temperature of the water inside the unit. It's got a nice handle, and just the cool part is it looks really cool. It looks really cool on your desk. It's not this big plastic thing. It's this nice glass kettle. A disclaimer, some people on Amazon, and we have a link to it on Amazon in the show notes, people say that it has like a plasticky chemical smell, which my unit definitely does, but it doesn't, it's not in the water. I think I've heard some reviews say that they think it's coming from the handle. So it is unpleasant for like, I mean, not terribly unpleasant. You're just kind of like, well, that smells like plastic. And then it goes away after it's boiled. I've never tasted it in the water. Some people are freaks, but I've had, four, five, six coworkers who also use this unit with me. They've never noticed a taste in the water or anything. Some people online were freaking out saying the water tastes like chemically plastic, and I've never noticed that.
The water's in glass. There's no plastic in the actual.
Well, there is. If you look at the heating element, there's sort of there's a silicon grommet around it where the glass sort of meets the metal element. And some people think that's where the plastic's coming from. One guy did some tests, and he's pretty sure the plastic smells coming from the handle because the handle is, sort of a plastic, and it does heat up. But It depends on your sensitivity, right? I guess some people on there were totally on Amazon were totally disgusted with it. I've had it for 4 months now, I think. I've never been turned off by it to the point of not using it.
Yeah.
I love it. It's great. When I use it at home, I always put filtered water in, but if you have hard water and boil it, after a while, you're gonna have to put some vinegar in to try and get some of the mineral deposits off, because they will accumulate. But
cool.
Actually, one of the benefits of working in a science lab was that I was able to use like full blown glacial acetic acid, which is like, you know, super high strength vinegar. Yeah. Acetic acid is the acid in vinegar. But so it really cleaned it out pretty quick. But so regular vinegar will take care of it as well.
So for the tea and caffeine fiends, this is perfect.
Right, yeah. If you just need hot water. And there was a while there at work too where I was getting frustrated with the coffee situation, because I was, we were having some people in our office who were drinking a lot of the coffee but not buying it. Our coffee wasn't supplied by work. You know, it was sort of the coworkers chipped in. Mm-hmm. And there were some people who definitely were not chipping in. And I for a while there, I was like, well, fine, I'm removing myself from the system by using my hot water kettle and making coffee. And so it's a great little tool. I like it a lot. It's the Cespresso H2O Plus Glass Water Kettle.
All right, so let's move on to web apps. What do we got this week?
The first web app I want to talk about is something I just found out about. I guess it's been out for a little while, but it's called the Google Local Business Center. And some people may have noticed that if you use Google Maps a lot, that when you've been searching for stuff, all of a sudden there's a lot more information about restaurants and places around town than you normally thought. And I think that's because they started implementing this. Mm-hmm. So what this does is it lets you go in, register your local business, and you can kind of control the way that Google displays information about your business. They say you can do things like you can put on coupon codes, you can customize, like an excerpt about what your restaurant is. So if you really want to focus on the fact that you're a local organic restaurant, you can put that in there. But I think the really, really cool part then is it gives you insights. And what it does is insights helps you see how and what people are doing to find your business on Google. So you can see, even based on location, like, wow, I'm a local business, but people all across town are searching for me. Yeah, or like if you live in California, you know, like one city away, they're searching for me. And so maybe, you know, I might want to think about opening another restaurant over there. Or you can see that all of a sudden when people are looking for, you know, Bozeman, Montana organic, you're getting a lot more search results for that. So you might want to tailor your website or your search results to really focus on that more, because that might be the demographic that's looking for you.
So does it tie into analytics, Google Analytics, or is it separate?
I think it's a separate thing. It really is. It's, you know, because analytics can kind of tell you things about your visitors as a whole, like they did come from Google, but this really ties in specifically to Google searches for your business and how and where and why people are searching for your business compared to your competitors around you.
So I live in a town where the phone book fits on like five page paper. And there's this new restaurant in town that they have some pizzas and I wanted to find out their phone number. But they weren't in this phone book, you know, because they're new. I actually did a search for Google just out of the blue. I was like, oh, they might have a website, you know, just a chance, you know. And this came up. It showed a map and it showed the place and it had their phone number. And I was like, so it's perfect for somebody that doesn't have the resources to make a website.
Right.
But they want a presence online. This is perfect.
Like, yeah. Because I think it's safe to say most searches are going through Google. So
it's like it's like putting your business in a phone book, like an online phone
book. And it helps Google know more about your business, which in turn helps people searching through Google find out about your business.
I have a listing on here for one of the businesses that I work for, and you know, we have business hours and contact information, what they do, payment information. It's great for putting a local listing.
Yeah. So check it out at google.com/LBC, the Local Business Center.
All right, what do we got next?
All right, the next web app we have is just a really simple one. It's from some website called photofriday.com, which I really actually can be honest, I don't think I've ever gone to, but I saw a link to this. And if you go to photofriday.com/calibrate.php, it brings up sort of just an image that helps you calibrate your monitor.
Okay, so you see some of these, sometimes you see this in like Xbox games or something. They want to get you to turn your TV's darkness down so it's more realistic when you're in dark corners or something.
Yeah, I mean, the whole point is to calibration is so that an image looks the same across different monitors. So like typical monitors go through RGB, but printers use something called CMKY. And the reason they use CMKY is because CMKY doesn't change. It's the same across all thing. I think if you, you know, if you, I think again,
well, then you get into PMS.
Right. And I think like, the whole point is that if you know, it's the image will be the same across different printers. If you have, you know, assuming you have the same thing. And with monitors, there is a big problem. Like for example, I'm on an iMac right now, which has a really great monitor behind it. These new aluminum iMacs, brilliant. But other monitors in my house are not. I have some older ones and they will display colors differently. So hopefully if you calibrate it, and this is a really cheap and easy way just to kind of get the right darkness. There are very expensive monitor calibrators out there where like some of them I think use, you know, you point your webcam at the screen or they even come with a specific sensor. Really? And then it automatically calibrates it so that, you know, but again, those are very expensive relative to just coming here. And this kind of gives you some guidelines and like, okay, so the goal is you should be able to barely see, you know, this color and then this color and that.
Is it mainly brightness and contrast or?
Yeah. Yeah. Color.
It's hard.
Darkness, brightness is probably the easiest because you can say like, you should only be able to see part of this. When you get into actual color calibration, that gets the most difficult. Like sometimes if you want that, they send you basically like a paint strip that you'd put up next to your monitor and try to make the colors the same. Or like we were talking about, there's usually some of them, there's a sensor. Those are usually more difficult. This is just a good first step to make sure that if your screen is like way too bright, you know, you might look at someone's photograph online on Flickr or something and be like, boy, that looks really washed out.
Yeah.
But it could be that just your monitor's washed out, you know, and this is just a good way to get towards that direction. If you're really serious about it, you need to look at some serious calibration tools out there.
This might be good for web designers when they're choosing light colors of gray and things. Monitors, like you might think, looking at your monitor, you might say, you can easily tell that this is the gray area, this gray box. Whereas on another monitor, it might look white.
Yeah.
Like it just blends in.
I mean, that's a great example. I totally just ran into this on a project I was working on. I received the Photoshop file, and I think what happens is the way Photoshop, it displays colors differently than other programs. So you open up the Photoshop document, and the colors were very rich and very dark. And I've read elsewhere that some browsers, like Firefox specifically, they sort of change the way colors, they display the colors to try and kind of calibrate them across different operating systems.
Huh.
It's sort of their attempt to like try and make them the same as much as they can within, you know, the fact that they're writing a program. So like when you looked at this layout in Firefox on like, let's say, you know, Windows, it looked really washed out. But if I looked at it in Chrome on my Linux machine, which I think the Chrome on Linux doesn't do any sort of color correction or anything like that, it looked very deep and rich, looked great. And I mean, I was kind of running into the trouble of this colors looking differently. And we had a client that was really, really wanted the colors to be more deep and rich. And it came to the point of, I said, I don't know what to do. I took the Photoshop file. I cut the image out of it, saved it as a JPEG with no compression. I don't know how to fix this.
Uh-huh.
And
it's you're just copying the actual color value,
right? And you know, the only solution most people could come up with was if you go into Firefox's about config, you could tell it to stop doing any color corrections
or
like
that.
I had no idea
they did color corrections. That's crazy.
Yeah, I mean, if you look at it, there's a lot of things in Firefox that tend to be more washed out. They tend to make the colors brighter,
huh?
Because I think it maybe accessibility, you know, because darker colors might be harder to see. I don't know, but it was very frustrating because I mean, I develop on Linux, right? And on Linux, it looked great. It was dark and rich, good deep browns. And then, you know, when
you're
looking
at, like, what's wrong with this? And they're like, hey, these colors are not the
same.
Yeah,
exactly. Oh. And I mean, I did the best I could to show them what was going on. I was like, you know, I take the color dropper tool in Photoshop. I click on this background color. It's this hex value. I take, you know, I go into Firefox and I got a plugin called ColorZilla that has a color dropper. I go into Firefox, I select that color dropper, I select that color. It's the same hex value. It's just the way it's manipulating it and displaying it before the screen. Very frustrating. I kind of get to the point where I was like, I don't know what to do. I really don't.
So maybe this tool will help get everybody on the same.
Right. It gets you closer to the same page, at least, you know, so that I could say at least then, you know, if they do this calibration, then I know it's probably not their monitor washing it out. It's probably something internally displaying colors differently.
Mm-hmm. Cool.
Wow, that was a long one for a little web app like that. If you guys, I want to remind you guys, if you have some news, follow-ups, or web application you want to check out, go to faceoffshow.com/feedback. Let us know. We want to hear about it and talk about what you guys want us to talk about. Let's get into our topic of the week, which is rest.
Rest.
And I don't mean sitting on the couch.
So when you talked about when we're talking about rest, we're talking about API kind of stuff, like you mentioned at the beginning of the show. So what is rest?
Well, can I interrupt you first?
Sure.
I mean, APIs are everywhere, mm-hmm. right?
Maybe we should start with what an API is.
What is an API?
What is it, advanced programming interface or something?
I think so. I think that's it. Basically, it's a way for us to programmatically get at each other's data, right? Instead of, you know, the most sort of common API is going to a web page and viewing it. That kind of is a way, but that's not very easy for programmers, right? To go and parse HTML and stuff. And,
right.
You know, so what most people do is they create, you know, a way for programmers to get at the data that is, you know, designed specifically for programs. Mm-hmm. So APIs are everywhere. It's kind of a common thing that
it's getting more and more popular. Yeah,
user generated content is all over the web. So it's kind of this thing of like, let's share data, let's find ways for you know, our stuff to talk, to do crosstalk and integrate information together. And so so I'm gonna ask you a question. When I hear of APIs and stuff, I sort of instantly think of SOAP.
SOAP.
What is SOAP? It is an API, right?
SOAP is a protocol.
SOAP is a protocol. Okay.
So SOAP is a protocol, much like HTTP is a protocol. Well, we'll get to what REST is, I guess. We'll keep that separate.
Right.
So SOAP is just like a wrapper for XML. It's a protocol that carries XML in a client-server fashion, like you request through POST, HTTP POST, and you send up some data, and the server gives you a response.
Okay.
That's SOAP.
Okay.
Most languages have SOAP built in. It's been around, and that's kind of
It's been around for a long time, right?
The way things have gone.
Okay.
So SOAP versus REST. REST is like an architectural guideline, not a protocol. So you can implement it however you kind of want, as long as you follow the rules.
Right. Which we'll talk about. So it's kind of like, this is how we think it should operate, you know, do this, and there's no like spec. Like I can't go and say this is HTTP REST compliant, right? It's a guideline. This is a good way of doing things.
Right. So one of the biggest downsides of SOAP is it disregards a lot of the HTTP existing capabilities, like authentication is built into HTTP, which, by the way, so REST just is put on top of HTTP protocol.
Okay.
So that's why. So REST can take advantage of these where SOAP doesn't. So authentication, caching, SOAP is just, you know, there's no caching.
Mm-hmm.
Well, there can be caching, but it's not like built in. You'd have to do that. Content type negotiation, you know, like the MIME types, give me XML, give me JSON, give me this, give me that. SOAP is just usually XML.
Okay.
Or I think it always is XML.
Okay.
Because it's built into the protocol.
Right.
And everything in SOAP is handled through HTTP POST. It doesn't use the HTTP like GET, put, delete.
Okay. Well, let's get into that then. So, I mean, I've heard RESTful, REST, all over the place. And I have a general idea about it, right? But so, I mean, tell me, like, what is REST?
So, like I said, REST is software architecture. It's just like a guideline. This is how you should probably kind of build stuff. It's not like a protocol. It was developed by Roy Fielding in 2000, which is the guy that... Well, he was one of the principal authors for HTTP 1.0 and 1.1, so he knows his stuff. REST wasn't just developed from, you know, a couple of companies. Like, so we're going to talk about some of the companies that are using REST. The first time I was introduced to REST was Twitter, and I thought REST was just something they kind of came up with because it was the first time I had ever heard of it. But it happens to be, you know, one of the people that really understands HTTP and the way we should be doing things on the internet thinks that REST is the way to go. And so that is kind of what REST is. And it stands for representational state transfer. One of the big rules in REST is everything should be stateless, no state.
Oh, okay.
So if you request something, you have to always provide your credentials every single time. Mm-hmm. There's no cookies or session, anything. Okay. You know, some of the sites that are using REST, like I said, you know, Twitter, for me at least, made me know what REST was. It was the first one that I thought brought it out. And then Amazon, eBay, Facebook, Yahoo, Flickr, YouTube. Mm-hmm. So a lot of the big ones are using REST.
So it's getting out there, right? I guess I thought it was older than 2000 for some reason. I always think a lot of these things have been around for ages, but Okay, so like we already kind of talked about sort of soap and what is another one is RPC. What's that?
That's remote procedure call. I'm not sure. I think it's just kind of like soap where you do a call and you get something back. Do those other ones?
So like you mentioned with soap, but so soap uses HTTP?
Yes, but just it doesn't use all the features of, you know, like authentication, caching, put, you know, delete, all that. It just uses a post.
Okay.
And it just posts XML.
Oh, okay.
But there's a protocol that's like, it's a standard protocol, so like a lot of languages have soap built in. You can just pass it like an array into this object, the soap object, and it does the rest for you.
Okay. Interesting.
So some of the differences, I mean, so rest verbs, I guess.
Right. This is like the heart of REST.
So this is what we're talking when we say like get and post and all this stuff. Right. HTTP has some verbs built in called like get, put, post, and delete.
Okay.
So when you do a get, when you go to like google.com, you're doing a get request. You're saying, give me some information.
Right. Most browsers most of the time are doing just get. It's just get, retrieve this information and bring it back to me. It's sort of the point of that verb, right? Just go get this information and return it to me.
Get, yeah, and so in HTTP, get can be cached, and this is where kind of when you do use REST, your get calls should be able to be cacheable.
Mm-hmm.
This is, you would never use get to do something that you wouldn't want to do more than once. Like you shouldn't, so like for an example, you wouldn't want to use a get call to purchase an airline ticket. Doing multiple get requests to the same thing shouldn't have any effect on anything major. In REST, they always say like you should be able to kind of specify the format when you do a get, like XML, JSON, YAML.
Mm-hmm.
Although with REST, any MIME type is allowed.
Okay.
So you could get binary data or
Base64 or anything
SOAP
like that.
Is pretty much just text XML.
Okay.
A put is where you're going to replace information. So and if you do two puts in a row, it shouldn't make any difference.
Right.
Because you're just replacing that same information.
Right.
So this is an example, I guess, of REST where they're just giving you rules. There's no like protocol. It's just as long as when you do a put, it does the same thing as doing one put.
But you're
in compliance.
It makes
REST.
Sense, like what you're talking about with an airline ticket. If you know they created a shopping cart for you, right, mm-hmm. and then you put this specific airline ticket, you know, in your thing, you're putting it in there. It shouldn't change if you happen to do it twice because you're just updating the information of that one ticket that's already there.
If you're doing a put.
So,
yes.
Yeah, so a put, you know, if you did it right, it would be a put, and you'd be like, okay, I'm putting this there, and they'd be like, okay, I know how to handle that because it's all good.
So actually, I think I should stop for a second here with the verbs. One of the advantages of REST and why they use these more, so SOAP uses POST only, mm-hmm. and one of the reasons where REST comes has some advantages is by using these verbs, you can actually tell the program, like the programming backend, what it knows what to do based on the verbs.
Right.
Whereas in SOAP, since you're always doing a post, if you want to do something that does create something or does delete something, you have to specify that in your XML that you're sending up. Whereas this, you could send the same exact information, but you could do, let's say, a put versus a post. A post would add the information. A put would replace it.
Right, and it goes to and it could go to the same URL too.
Same
so like
URL, same.
You know, you're going to whatever /shopping cart/1, but depending upon what verb you do with that URL, it depends on how it handles it, right?
Right.
So if I'm doing a put to that URL, that means I'm replacing the information there.
Yes.
I mean, assuming this is implemented correctly.
And then the other kind of disadvantages of SOAP is you're always sending the information typically to the same URL. But the only thing that changes what you're doing is the calls you're making in your XML. So the programmer is put in the place where they have to implement all these functions and things in their side instead of the server side. Whereas I would just go to a different URL and that it would know that I'm talking about that function versus I have to make some special XML saying that I'm using this function.
Right.
So back to the verbs. Post would be to add information.
Right.
If you posted twice, so you're going to do it twice. And then delete would be to eliminate information.
So, I mean, every major web browser pretty much only supports two RESTful verbs by default.
Get and post.
Get and post, right? And you know this if you've done any programming because you, when you do your form, you say method
get or
either
post.
Get or post. And, you know, get puts it, which is, you know, technically according to the, you know, the RESTful ideas is wrong that you put it all in the URL, right, as query string variables up in the URL. And post actually does do the post REST verb with the data held in the protocol.
And since I've always worked in the browser. I always thought there was just Git and Post, and I had to go look it up, and actually Git, Put, Post, and Delete are actually part of the HTTP spec.
Yeah.
You can actually do those. It's just not in a browser.
Yeah.
Which I thought, I never knew. I thought Put was just like a special way to do a post, like hit, you know, send a hidden field.
Right.
I thought it was like a hack around, but
yeah,
I guess it's not.
So, I mean, the RESTful verbs basically support what, and again, since I, you know, kind of like the world of CRUD, right? Create, read, update, delete. Mm-hmm. You know, those are sort of the basic operations that you do in a lot of web applications. So if you take that web application and you want to put it on a REST API, that's okay, because those are like the four things you want to do anyways.
Right.
Normally.
So some little tips or rules, part of the verb verbiage is, you know, users should never be accountable for issuing a GET request. They shouldn't do anything that they would be accountable for.
Right.
You know, like the example we already gave, like buy an airline ticket. It should be safe to repeat a put or a delete. A delete shouldn't, I mean, it should delete that object that you're doing it on. If you hit it twice or something, it shouldn't like delete something else.
Yeah.
And if two, you know, we talked about this too. If two puts went through, it shouldn't buy the airplane ticket twice.
Right. It should just be replacing the information for that one record.
Some of the other rules with statelessness, it shouldn't matter if the request goes to this one server or another server. They're going to get the same information back, so those have to be, they should talk to each other in the back end. Authentication is going to be provided with every request, because there's no state, there's no session or cookie or anything.
Mm-hmm.
The same URL should give the same data back, regardless, you know, of cookies or anything, because there is none with REST.
Right.
And what this allows you to do, the power of that, is you're able to replace a server with another, no problem. You can do load balancing, all that stuff, because you don't have to worry about state. And it says you can do state, you can technically do these things with state, but it's a lot more cost prohibitive. And so REST, they just,
right,
it's part of the REST is you shouldn't do it that way.
Okay. So, I mean, the reason we were talking about this is because you and I were actually playing around the other day and we were implementing a REST API, which we found out is not as hard as we thought. We thought it was getting pretty difficult. What I did find out, though, is I didn't know nearly as much about REST as I should have.
Right.
Right.
Me either.
Because my coworker Paul showed me this. There's a Firefox plugin called Poster, I think, was it?
Yep.
And it's just a Firefox plugin that allows you to do all kinds of RESTful stuff easily. In like,
browser.
And there's a lot of stuff that, I mean, I definitely should probably review maybe the HTTP spec and stuff, because I was like, I don't know what to put in here to make this interact correctly. And there is. But if you want to implement a REST API, it's pretty easy these days. There's a lot of frameworks supporting it.
Yeah, pretty much all the web frameworks now are doing REST if you want to do the API. Like, if you want to add API, they have functions and classes to do REST. Some of these frameworks, you know, Django, Ruby on Rails, Sinatra, we've talked about.
Mm-hmm.
In the PHP world, there's Zend framework, Cake, PHP, CodeIgniter, Symfony. They all allow that.
Right. And some of them, it is kind of funny to see how they have to sort of hack around the fact that browsers can only do two of the verbs, right? So, like, a browser can't do natively a delete
or a put,
right? A delete or a put verb, you know, REST call. So they have to do things like, they kind of, you know, so maybe they might put a hidden field in the form so that the backend server can say, oh, if this is, you know, treat it like it was actual. But then once you get into, but that's the funny part is I got used to kind of all these hacks looking at it, just implementing it via, you know, the web browser,
so
right?
You think that the button doesn't even exist.
Exactly. And then so when we were doing it, I was like, do I have to put a funky field in this REST call to make it, you know, delete or put? And it's like, no, because the server is doing it the right way.
Right.
The server knows how to handle, you know, put and delete. It's the browser that we have to kind of work around to make it do the way they should.
Mm-hmm. So, I mean, I'm seeing a lot of services now offer APIs, and I think I've actually done implementations with REST APIs and SOAP, and I have to say that REST is by far, I mean, just an order of magnitude easier to implement a REST API than SOAP.
I think so too. I'm obviously a fan of it, because it seems the most familiar, right? I mean, we're used to going, and once you sort of understand the underlying goo behind it, it makes sense that every web page I'm going to is a GET request returning, you know,
right,
text, right? But then instead you say, okay, well, I'm going to do a GET request, but I want it to return, you know, JSON or XML. And it makes a lot more sense because you're like, oh, I've been doing that already. I've been doing it ever since I've had a web browser. Mm-hmm. So I like REST APIs.
So if you're, you know, chances are eventually you'll probably want to use some sort of API in your website, whether it be like displaying your Twitter feed on your website or something. You'll probably run into REST or, you know, SOAP at one point in time, and it's good to check out.
Yeah, check them out. Let us know. Go to faceoffshow.com/feedback. Let us know your experiences or any insights or thoughts that we may have missed in the show. We want to hear from you guys. That is it, and we appreciate it, you guys listening, and we'll see you next week.